let's get on with the show. You know, when you look at the headlines of the last year or so, heck, just the last few months, you got terror attacks on American embassies, piracy on the high seas, political intrigues, and we're always talking about the best aspects of leadership at sea and ashore. But that's not just what you're reading there on the newspaper or online. That's actually some of the topics you're going to find in the latest book by our guest, Claude Berube, and his book is called The Aden Effect. Claude's articles have appeared in Orbis, Naval History, Vietnam History, and Jane's Intelligence Review, Naval Institute Proceedings, also the Christian Science Monitor. He's also been a regular here over the last 3 years on MIDRATS. He also worked at Capitol Hill and for the Office of Naval Intelligence. He's a lieutenant commander in the U.S. Navy Reserves. He served twice overseas, including a deployment to the Persian Gulf Expeditionary Strike Group 5. He currently teaches at the United States Naval Academy. And Claude, you just dialed into the show. Welcome to MIDRATS.
Thanks. Can you hear me okay, Sal?
Ah, you sound perfect. Sure do.
Perfect.
Hey, just kind of set the foundation going forward here. I just gave the abbreviated title to your latest book. The title of your book, fully, I guess, would be The Aden Effect, a Connor Stark novel. What is the general plot of The Aden Effect, and who is Connor Stark?
The 30-second plot is Connor Stark is a disgraced former naval officer turned mercenary, if you will, who has settled in Scotland. He's recalled to active duty to serve as the defense attaché in Yemen, where to deal with pirates who are attacking U.S. oil platforms in the Gulf of Aden and a potential insurgency in Yemen. And Connor Stark is, I see Connor Stark as the naval officer who had a great career ahead of him and has had to make difficult decisions along the way, and those decisions resulted in him no longer being a naval officer and turning to other means to get by.
You go on?
Well, I'm kind of ashamed that you didn't ask me before using my biography to create your hero, other than he went to Boston University and was a disgraced naval officer and turned into a merc and all that stuff. Anyway, I've had a chance to read the book. It's a good book. Tell me
Thanks.
About how you shifted from writing historical fact books to a fictional piece like this.
Sure. It wasn't so much as a shift as an evolution with both fiction and nonfiction. In 1988-89, as I was getting out of college, I actually wanted to write a novel. That's what I wanted to start with. And I was reading the books of Robert B. Parker, who had the Spencer series, and, of course, Clancy, and William F. Buckley Jr.'s Blackford Oak series. And I had this idea for a modern Horatio Hornblower or Jack Aubrey series where you start with the first book where he's a junior officer and continues on. I know a few other people have done that too. But, you know, I tried it over a few years here and there, wrote some chapters here and there, and you know what? It just didn't work out. They just didn't work. And so I ended up writing nonfiction. But I always had this idea that I'd still really like to use a couple of these characters in a storyline. And in 2008, I was traveling through Ireland, Scotland, and England, and I happened to come across this incredible little town called Ullapool on the west coast of Scotland. And as I was walking along the docks, something struck me about the town. I said, you know what, this is the kind of town that character, Connor Stark, would have wound up in. And it was sort of like it was my epiphany for the story of the book, because J.K. Rowling, who wrote the Harry Potter series, apparently she was in a train or something, and she had that one moment where she suddenly had everything come together. And so as I was wondering, why is this naval officer in a little town called Ullapool? And that's when I started to reverse engineer the character about I had to go through his career. How would he exactly wind up in this little-known town in Scotland? And that's since I was already working on maritime security stuff, I thought that would be a good tie-in and the reason why he would wind up here. And I sort of built up the career that way. And for the next year, I took a lot of notes whenever I could. And in the summer of 2009, I just really had an opportunity to write the thing. I gave it the first draft, 3,000 words a day. I was just really focused on it that summer. And, 20, 25 edits and drafts later, the book is finally released tomorrow, officially, although it's a few copies have already been out.
We covered the northern part of some of the scenes that your book travels through, but the centerpiece of the novel is, hence the title, The Aiden Effect, is Yemen. Why Yemen?
When I was drafting out this story, I knew that it had to deal somehow with Somali pirates, but the pirates wouldn't necessarily be the focus. I needed a country that was in the region that bordered the Gulf of Aden or the Northern Arabian Sea that would be plausible enough that it would be, if it was destabilized, that it would cause far more problems than anything else. And I just took out my map and I said, okay, Djibouti's a possibility, Eritrea too far away, Saudi too far away, UAE, Oman, and then I just said, you know what, Yemen. And then I started looking at the map, and there's a particular island that is Yemeni. It's called Socotra. And as I started doing more research into Socotra Island, I said, that's it. That's what I need. I needed the country that controls that particular island. Because in the book, it's again, since it's a work of fiction, there are no oil platforms off Socotra. In the book, there are. They're under construction. So that provided the geographical purpose for the book. And I met more Yemenis, and I did some more research into the region, and it just simply tied in together. And as I was writing it, the Saleh was still in power. That's changed just in the past year. So, you know, one of the downsides of trying to remain credible is simply things that happen beyond your control after you've already written it. So my assumption was that the Saleh government would still be in power for a while, or a Saleh-like government, because, again, this could have been Oman, it could have been UAE, it could have been any one of these, where there is a strong power in charge of the government, as well as a number of family members who are a part of the government.
When you started writing the book, and I'm saying this because my mother was a professional writer, she used to do a lot of work with writers groups, where she would submit discuss work with writers groups. Were you doing that as you were going through this book? Were you working with a writers group?
Absolutely. There was a writers group, like a more formal one. There was, and I mentioned them in the acknowledgments, the Ink and Drink. These were a bunch of guys from the Naval Academy. We taught various courses, and we used to get together once in a while and read each other's works. We had somebody who was a poet from the English department. We had a couple guys from the history department. At that time, I was in a different department. And we would just get together, have a few drinks, and comment on each other's work to try to improve it. And I think that first meeting with the Ink and Drink, where they just ripped it apart to its bones, really helped out a lot. I also did work with some local writers groups, one in D.C. that I was involved with. And then I also worked with, I hired an editor. I said, look, here's what I want to do, and here's my product. And so she and I spoke about this we had several sessions where we talked about character development and plot lines and such. And that was incredibly important. And I think when you sit down and write a book, you don't think about those things. It's like being a naval officer. You've got to go through particular training in order to be a commanding officer. You've got to, you know, go to Naval War College. You've got to do some other things. So in that way, I think it was incredibly important for me to work with those people even before I could bring it to an agent. And I did bring it I had pitched it to a bunch of agents. In fact, there's one writer's group, and they have these all across the country. There was a writer's conference with a lot of agents, and what you do is you sign up and, you know, you get like 10 minutes with an agent. It's almost like speed dating for agents. You pitch your idea, and then you talk about it for a while. And the funny thing, that the one I always remember, is this one agent in, I guess it was 2010, said to me, you know, this is a really fascinating idea. I really like the idea, but vampires are really big right now. Can you tie in vampires somehow? And I looked at him and I said, some Somali vampires? He goes, yeah, can you do that? I said, do you want the Navy to be like werewolf vampire hunters? He said, can you do that too? And I said, you know, maybe this isn't the right format for me. You know, I'm not really into that. So it's kind of
please,
funny that.
Please tell me alcohol was involved because that's hilarious.
You know, maybe on his part, but, you know, I was dry. It was 10 a.m., so it was kind of funny. But eventually, you know, I had an agent, pitched it to a bunch of the firms up in New York, but it wound up in the hands of Naval Institute Press, who took a look at it and decided to take a chance. And so we'll see what happens at this point. And they've been great. Their editing process, their publicity folks, their entire team at Naval Institute Press, I can't say enough good things about them.
One of the background stories, and you touched on it briefly in the novel, are private maritime security companies. What role do private maritime security companies have in the real world, and what role do they play in your book?
Sure. They have become far more robust in the past 5 years, as we've discussed before, with the rise of Somali piracy up until about 18 months ago. And before the various coalitions, the EU and NATO and everybody else really started to work together, the best way to protect a ship was with armed guards. And, you know, I think we're going to start to see that abate a little bit now that there have only been something like five or six ships that have been taken by pirates this past year. You're starting to really see a dynamic shift. So will shipping companies still employ them? You know, chances are they're going to shift as well. But you saw it's 5 or 6 years ago. You probably had 6 or 12 maritime security companies. The last I knew, there was something like over 200, over 120 of which had been accredited with SAMI, which is the Industry Security Association. And that's the reality. Some of them do have ships too. PVI has several ships, and a few others do as well. In the book, there is a maritime security company that has several ships, and that's the maritime security company that Stark was involved with before he eventually left to go to Scotland. And we see these ships in action. What they're doing is they're protecting a U.S. construction firm as it's taking supplies from Yemen to the coast of Socotra, where the U.S. oil platforms are being built.
You know, you hopped on in a hurry, and we didn't give you a chance to add your usual disclaimer about your opinions. You want to go ahead and do that now? And the process of doing that, Andrew, one of the questions that showed up in the chat room, which was, did you have to get this book looked at by the DOD before you got it into print?
Sure. Standard disclaimer, the views I express are my own and not those of the Navy or the United States Naval Academy. The second part of that is I did submit the concepts. I ran it by – there's two ways to answer this. There's three ways. Number one, there is nothing in there – and I'm an intel officer, there is nothing in there that discusses any kind of OPSEC issues or anything remotely intel related. The second thing is I ran it by our public affairs officer, and I talked to our judge advocate general as well, where I'm currently serving. The third issue is I also ran, if there were chapters that dealt with surface warfare issues, I wanted to make sure something was credible, but that I would not violate any OPSEC. So I pulled in my SWO buddies and said, hey, read this. Is this correct? And am I violating anything? In terms of the helicopters, the SH-60s that are operating on the ship, I did the same thing with pilots that I knew. And the same was true with some State Department issues. I talked to guys who are both in and out of State Department, just say, hey, look, can you just do a sanity check? Is this okay? So that's what I've done.
I wanted to back up a little bit for something you touched on a couple of answers ago, Claude. And just because I know you're a member of, you talked about the one group of writers that get together, and there's other organizations of independent writers. You compare notes to each other, provide advice. And also, as an individual, every time you do something, you learn something new. And one thing I was thinking about over the last 9 months, in the course of finishing up and refining your novel and going through the process of finding an editor and a publisher, everything, the Arab Spring waxed, and then it kind of degenerated to where we are right now. And did you ever feel like perhaps your novel was a little bit too timely and too much from the headlines? And were there changes you had to make while you watched what was going on in the background? And is there something that you kind of internalized as a lesson for yourself or other fiction writers who might be looking at a novel that's really close to the bleeding edge of what's happening in the news?
Yes. On the first question, absolutely. In fact, there were things happening in, as I was finishing the edits, there were things happening in Yemen that I was like, oh man, wow, I can't believe that's happening. Or the Arab Spring, there were some things that I didn't feel comfortable about, especially as individuals were proclaiming, oh, this is great for democracy throughout the Middle East. And the one thing that I kept coming back to was a couple of articles I had done for Vietnam Magazine. I interviewed the then last two surviving members of the OSS team that had been sent into Indochina in the summer of 1945 to train these 80 to 100 Viet Minh Army guys and the leaders named Ho and Giap, who we would fight 20 years later, Ho Chi Minh and General Giap. But we trained them during the summer of 1945, and I think history tends to forget that. And I kept thinking as this was happening, who are we training now? And that came about as I was thinking about the family that I discuss in the Yemeni family that I discuss in the Aden Effect. There were things, especially the past month with Libya and the riots and the storming of part of the embassy in Yemen. Absolutely, I would get emails from folks who had read the book and said, "Hey, you know, just want to let you know this stuff's happening." And I was like, "Geez, you know, who knew?" The other thing on the about being close to the leading edge, you know, why wouldn't a writer want to be close to the leading edge? Because hopefully, as people read this book, you know, if somebody doesn't know about private security companies, maybe this is going to give them a different view or encourage them to learn about it. If they don't know anything about Yemen, perhaps this will be the impetus for them to read more of real history and current events about Yemen, or, as I would argue, about ethics. And ethics play a huge role in this book, especially with the main character, Connor Stark. In fact, in the beginning of the book, I have a quote from Martin Luther King Jr. who wrote in 1963 in a letter from a Birmingham jail, and he said, "We should never forget that everything Adolf Hitler did in Germany was legal, and everything the Hungarian freedom fighters did in Hungary was illegal." And that really goes to the core of who Connor Stark is. Sometimes he does things that may not be necessarily legal, but there are things that he sees as right or just, and the question is, are they really right or just in terms of other people or just according to Connor Stark? The same is true with the diplomatic security agent Damian Golzari, or even for the ambassador to Yemen, Caroline C.J. Sumner, who faces her own dilemmas. So I would argue, why wouldn't you want to try to be on the leading edge of a particular issue?
Well, I can't think of a reason why you wouldn't want to be. You know, I think that was part of the interest that I had in reading the book was you're talking about places where events are currently unfolding and situations which could unfold. How much, a lot of your knowledge, how seemed to be pretty good of the areas described? I mean, I've never been in Yemen, but how much on the ground work did you do to get or had you done to know these areas as well as you seem to have known them?
Sorry, Eagle One, can you repeat that question about Yemen?
I'm not sure I can repeat it all, but what kind of legwork did you do to know some of these areas to the level that you've described them in the book?
Gotcha. I did speak with people who live there. I spoke with Yemenis. There was one particular one who was, in observing him, was particularly helpful. You know, books, articles, The Economist, anything I could read about that particular country that I thought would be helpful to give some sort of historical background. Because I, to be honest with you, before I wrote it, I didn't know that much about Yemen. I didn't know its history. But there were some interesting books that came out of the one in particular in the 60s about some private security folks in the British in Yemen that were doing some things. So I really actually went back a couple of thousand years of Yemeni history to really pull some things, not to really take away from the story, but to really support the story and gain an appreciation so that the characters you saw were gaining an appreciation and an understanding for where they were. This is particularly true at one particular battle on land in Yemen that Connor Stark is involved with, and I wanted to make sure that the area I was discussing was accurate. The other thing was there is one of the characters that Stark deals with, Mutahar, who is a Yemeni businessman, has this magnificent palatial estate in the middle of Yemen, and Damian Golzari, the diplomatic security agent, is really trying to wonder, you know, who is this Mutahar? But that really came about when I was going through, I'm forgetting now if it was UAE or Oman. It was, but just taking a vehicle through one of these, and I remember just seeing in the distance this incredibly huge estate, and that's where the idea of Mutahar's own estate came from. It's not exactly described as what I saw, but I was able to embellish by learning about Yemeni and Arabic architecture.
Let's flesh out one of the characters. We've talked about Connor Stark, who obviously is a central character, but you've also mentioned another very important character in your novel, one that brings an interesting background into the play, and that's Damian Golzari. Who is Damian Golzari, and what role does he play in The Aiden Effect?
Sure. Let me preface that with the three main characters. I wanted to see how each of these reacted to a crisis. In this case, it was the Aiden Effect. So initially, I had this bold idea. I'm going to have one of these guys represent the philosophies of John Locke, another one of Thomas Hobbes, another one of Jeremy Bentham, and then I was like, yeah, you know what, that's just not going to work. So what I wanted to do was show Sumner as Ambassador Sumner as the agent of diplomacy of the state. She's the soft power person. She believes in humanitarian relief operations and negotiations. Stark, it represents the pariah, the guy who's the non-state actor, and you don't know what he's going to do. He's from day to day. Damian Golzari represents the state and security. He's not only a State Department agent, I'm talking with small s, state security. He is an Iranian emigre. His father was this is part of the backstory, that his father was a general to the Shah of Iran, and that's why they left in 79. His education was mostly from the general's bodyguards, some of whom were the Savak, who were not particularly, the most upright people, perhaps. He's British educated, very well educated, but winds up as a cop for a while before he joins diplomatic security because he sees the United States as the preeminent counterbalance to what he saw in the Middle East with the rise of the Islamists. So Damian Golzari has his own reasons for securing the United States government.
All right, let's talk a little bit about the ship, the U.S. Navy ship that is in the book, which seems to be captained by every SWO's surface warfare officer's nightmare. And I know you disclaimed that it was in anybody you knew and specifically said it was not, it took all the features of one of your skippers, I guess, and said this was complete opposite. But how much input did you have from surface warfare officers on having that particular kind of CO?
He is the nameless captain of the USS Bennington, the CG-74. There's a reason that he's nameless. There was, what was that movie, Jack Nicholson, As Good as It Gets, where he's a novelist, and this woman says, how do you understand women so well? And he says, I remove reason and accountability. You know, I take a start with a man, and I remove reason and accountability. For this character, there was an individual, he wasn't captain of my ship, but this particular captain I served under twice overseas, and I can't hold anyone in higher regard than this individual, and I mention him in the acknowledgments. And so what I did is I said, what if because he had been a swell but is no longer a swell. So what if he had been the captain? I said, no, wait a minute. What if it was somebody completely opposite of him? Because that would create more tension on the ship. So I took every positive character trait from this individual, and I simply got the antonym. And that's simply how I came up with the captain. That plus all the stories you started reading in the Navy Times and elsewhere about the various CEOs who had been relieved of command over the past couple of years and the things that they had been accused of doing. And I said, you know what, that's the kind of individual that I want. You know, we see somebody, in fact, in the book, you know, I mentioned it, one of the junior officers is being told to read the Kane Mutiny on board the ship, which sort of sets up a few things that happen later on. But you see there's elements of Captain Queeg, but you know what? Captain Queeg seems like a great skipper compared to the captain of the Bennington. But in reality, he's not anybody that I ever served with. It's the complete opposite.
I want to dive into another character you mentioned before. And with all due respect to her character and the role that she plays, but in the character of C.J. Sumner, and I'm speaking as one of these types of people, you seem to have created kind of the fantasy women for policy wonks that have a deep and abiding affection for strong, smart, serious, but sexy women all wrapped up into one little nice package. And I won't bring out my names here, but I saw a little flavors of different characters that in real world that we've all seen, and to develop a really complicated character in Ambassador Sumner. If you wouldn't mind naming names, were there some of the finer characteristics of some of the individuals that the reader might know that went into the stew of creating the character of C.J. Sumner?
In fact, I gave a talk up in Syracuse this past week to an organization. Then before that, I gave one to a book club, and it was an all-women's book club. And I was actually very frank with them. I said, look, if you're looking for a book that has Fabio with a woman draped over his arm, you know, my books aren't it. I have been around very strong women of strong, very strong character all my life. My mother was a state legislator for 30 years and kind of fought the powers that be. I served with women in the military who were just incredible officers. And so I didn't want somebody who was this demure, you know, vacillating kind of individual. I wanted somebody that we could relate to in the 21st century as the other way. Actually, if you look at the other women in the novel as well, there's the XO of the Bennington. There's the captain of one of the private security ships. And of course, there's another character we'll probably talk about later. But I wanted somebody who was intelligent, who was experienced in diplomacy. You know, there's probably a little bit of Condi Rice in her, maybe. But, you know, it really came from I wanted somebody who was new to the job but experienced enough that it would just take a little bit for them to really succeed. And at the beginning of the book, you know, there's actually a very important leadership question in this book with regard to C.J. Sumner. She's in charge. But she has two people in that first meeting, a businessman and her current defense attaché, a Marine lieutenant colonel. And things just aren't working out. She knows that. So she's going to have to make a decision on changing her team. And sometimes that's what good CEOs do. You actually have to find the right people to do the job right. And I think in the case of C.J. Sumner, she may not have liked the way she had to do it, but she knows that she has to change the team if she wants to accomplish the mission.
I guess one of the other things that was interesting to me, and I'm sure this has to do with your background, although I hope it's not firsthand experience, but you really were paying pretty hard on some of the political infighting that goes on in D.C. in this book. You want to talk about that a little?
I don't think it's a secret that there hasn't been political infighting since 1787. You know, so if anybody says, well, you know, the Aid and Effect has somehow talking poorly about Washington, you know, let's talk about the campaign of 1800 or some of the things that have happened in the past 200 years. This is not an indication of any administration. In fact, I wrote when I started taking notes, it was 2008 before I knew who was going to be the president. So I really tried to stay away from politics in this. there is political fighting, but you really don't know for a fact whose side is whose. Because the way I have the president, who you don't see very often, and the chief of staff in the White House, you kind of get a sense maybe, but it really could be either party in reality. I just needed to set up some conflict, and that was what you see in the book is the best way I could set up the conflict. I don't think if I didn't have conflict, it'd be worth reading. You know, I think every novel needs that. You know, how is CJ actually going to get the security personnel that she needs after she's been begging Washington for so long? You know, how is Washington going to deal with a potentially rogue ambassador? So, and the people she surrounded herself with. And so these are political questions, but they're not directed toward any current political party or current issues.
We're talking about CJ and another composite character of yours that kind of plays into the political background. I thought you did a really good job with Elliot Green. By the end of the novel, you have this picture in your head of what he must look like. It's not an attractive picture. And there are two or three well-known politicians that I think if you put them together would mold into that character quite well. So good job on Elliot Green. I won't say much more about him because you got to read the book to be able to flesh it out. So.
Yeah, I will say, and as a follow-up to Eagle One, look, I'm a reservist currently on active duty for another few months, but in my civilian career, I did work for a couple of senators, and I worked for one from the Democrat, one who was a Democrat, and I worked for a senator who was a Republican. So, again, there's no, you know, attacks on a particular party. I've worked for both sides, so, you know, I'll leave it at that.
Now, and I thought you're very fair with it, and you're right. When you read it, you could be from either side of the political spectrum, and you can hang your demons political party on any of the bad players, and I thought it was well balanced in that respect, Claude. And for those
Thanks.
That are joining us late, our guest is Claude Berbe. He is the author of his latest book, and I believe your first nonfiction book, The Aiden Effect, a Connor Stark novel. And I may be projecting a little bit here, but I don't think I'm projecting too much. But as you read the book, you cover a swath. You know, you go from Scotland through England, and of course you go through the Horn of Africa area, but there's also a little bit of India that plays in here. There's almost an undercurrent and a thread, especially when the way nations think about global issues from a maritime perspective, a little bit of the Anglosphere continuity of England and her former colonies, and how they work together in the international sphere. In the real world, what is your view of the Anglosphere as it's kind of congealing the last few decades, and how does that undercurrent run in the relationships and some of the plots that people will find as they read the novel?
You know, I think that has less to do with I see where you're going with that, and yes, there is a role for India in this book, you know, very strong, interesting, and long history with Great Britain, Scotland, and certainly portions of Yemen, at least. I know Aden and a couple of other ports have been used by Great Britain. But I really wanted to look more at how there are domestic and international conflicts within any country, and I wanted to really study, and I'll do this with subsequent novels as well, three factors. Number one, the decline of comparative Western naval power. Not simply the decline of power, but the decline of comparative power. The second is the rise of China, and sometimes not so overtly, particularly in this book, as we've seen in Africa, and I saw in several Caribbean island nations several years ago. And the third aspect is the rise of non-state actors, and that's not only it's not only pirates, it's not only terrorists, but they are the non-state actors. They are the unknown quantities, the Julian Assanges of this world. And so those are the themes that I'd really like to explore through the eyes of Connor Stark, Damian Golzari, and C.J. Sumner in future books. But I would agree with you that England still has a significant role. They call it what's their annual conference? I think it's CHOGM, the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting. I happened to be in Scotland one year when they were having that, which, you know what, made it really difficult to golf on the old course at St. Andrews. I was just really upset that Prime Minister Majors decided to come over that day to golf. So I was, anyway, but you're right. There is a very strong thread among these former colonial powers who are continuing their relationship even now in the 21st century. The question is, for the United States, which has not had that colonial experience, are our diplomatic overtures as possible as say from Great Britain because of their expertise with these countries?
I want to talk a little bit more about the writing aspect of this book, and one of the, I guess one of the ways to look at it is as you decided on a main character, his attributes. How did you decide? I mean, how do you work through that? Were there certain things you were looking for that you knew he had to have, or did other people suggest things to you that this particular character had to know or was capable of doing?
No. When I started off, I mentioned to you earlier in the show that Connor Stark, when I originally envisioned him about 24 years ago now, he was going to be this naval officer and have a great career ahead of him. And I also did want to have an additional aspect. I wanted him to be an Olympic athlete, and he's a pentathlete, or he was. So in the course of his career, you expect to have this great 20, 25-year career, and as he hoped to reach command level, to command a surface combatant. Well, sometimes your dreams go by the wayside, and in the case of Connor Stark, one thing happened to him. He was the victim of – he and some other officers were victim of a terrorist attack by the Red Brigade in Italy during his first or second tour. And then later in his career, he makes a decision because of that first incident with regard to terrorists that gets him court-martialed and gets him out of the Navy that he loved. So I knew that he had to have some sense of honor, but he had to have a sense of justice, but that justice sometimes would get him into trouble. And that's how I started forming the character of the new Connor Stark as I envisioned him. Living in Ullapool, because it gave him a couple of things. Number one, it primarily gave him the freedom to do some things in the novels that he might not normally do as another character. For example, I think you guys, we all grew up reading the Tom Clancy Jack Ryan series. He is not Jack Ryan. Jack Ryan rises through the ranks because he does the right things and they're all legal. And, you know, I think in Clear and Present Danger, he's referred to as a Boy Scout. Connor Stark is not a Boy Scout. He probably was going to be a Jack Ryan type, but he just fell by the wayside by doing some things that making decisions that he had to make at the time. So that gave the character some flexibility in what I could do in this book and hopefully in subsequent books.
That's a great lead-in for up in the chat room. BJ brought out a well-defined writer geek question. But as you were working on the novel, was the first draft pretty long? And as you edited it down or got shorter, maybe expanded some parts as the news changed, how did that work with the editor as the novel progressed down to a smoother format? And you've already implied a bit, and it's kind of a giveaway, a Connor Stark novel, that there's hopefully with the success this one has, we'll see some more down the road. Did some of the items that had to get cut out of the first draft going to reappear perhaps in follow-on books?
Excuse me. Yeah, the first question, I want to distinguish between two editors. There was the editor I initially worked with before I submitted it to the agents, and then there was the editor at Naval Institute, or the editorial team at Naval Institute. When I first set out on this book, in the research that I had done and in the writers' groups I was involved with, I knew that a debut novel was supposed to be about 80,000 words and that agents and publishing houses generally wouldn't consider anything more than 80,000. That said, I probably went to about 90 or 95,000 on the first draft. And in the course of working with the editor, I found that I had too many voices speaking in the book that was getting too confusing. So in some cases, I actually combined characters. In fact, one of the bad guys in the book is a composite of two bad guys that I had in the first draft. And that really allowed me to shape the character much better, really refine that particular character. And so I had to whittle it down a little, probably about 10,000 words, but just because I whittled it down doesn't mean I didn't do anything else. They were entire chapters. If I were to pull the original manuscript, it's almost completely different from what you might read today. There are entire chapters that were thrown out because they just weren't relevant or whatever, or they provided too much background on a character. So, and then the editors at Naval Institute really helped me refine something. So, regard to the second question, yes, there are some things that I tossed out that will probably reappear. There were actually chapters from something I tried about 10, 15 years ago. There's a common theme that I mentioned that Stark is court-martialed, and the reason he's court-martialed that it comes out in the book because he was an officer on Capitol Hill as one of these fellows, and he learns about a Canadian terrorist cell that he has to deal with, and nobody will listen to him, so he decides to take direct action instead. And there's a whole backstory there, and that's why Ambassador Sumner and Stark know each other in this book, because they were both there for that incident. Well, there's an entire backstory to that, and what I'd really like to do, as I've got the next four books planned out, is revisit that in a very different format. So there are some things that I'll use, and there's some things that I just won't use that were just like, really? Seriously, I wrote that? Yeah, that's just not going to work. So it really depends. What drives the story? If it drives the story, it stays in. If it doesn't drive the story, it gets cut.
Well, speaking of stories, you've been toting this book around, I guess, in your mind and in various forms for a while. Tell me about how you go through the process of selling the book. I know you've met some interesting writers along the way. How did you get? Yeah. How did you get the author of one of my favorite books, Stephen Pressfield, to give you such a nice blurb on the back of your book?
Yeah.
Photograph.
You know, it's funny. Actually, before I answer that question, just to clarify something on the Canadian terror cells, the reason why I was kind of interested in that particular storyline is when I was in grad school, and actually when I was a little kid, I remember distinctly the FLQ, which was the Liberation Front of Quebec, which dominated politics when I was a very young kid in New England, and I had some cousins still up in Quebec, so that was the genesis for that particular storyline. Anyway, so the writers themselves, some were approached by the publisher. Some I just contacted through third parties and said, and they actually, in one case, in Stephen Pressfield's case, a friend of mine actually had the manuscript. And he said, hey, can I borrow this manuscript for a little bit? I got to send it to somebody. So he apparently sent it to Stephen Pressfield, and he apparently really liked it, and that's why the first blurb on the back of the book is from Pressfield. The same was true with Rich Miniter. Sent a copy of the advanced copy to Rich, who I had met years ago when I was he had actually hired me as a special correspondent for the Washington Times. I was going to take a leave of absence from the academy. I was a civilian adjunct at the time, and I was supposed to actually go out on Blackwater's ship, as well as a Maersk ship, and I was going to write stories as well as a book about the experiences, and that's when piracy was at its height in early 2009. So I knew Rich. I'm trying to think who. Bob Kaplan, very prolific author, and we sent the manuscript to him as well. And there were some others that we sent them to, but they weren't able to respond in time. Some did respond, but after the book went to press, but it'll probably be with the if there's a soft cover version, I'll probably go with that. So,
we talked about the three main characters, and there are a couple of minor characters that at least I hope will show up later on. Ensign Fisk, I think, it has some interesting flavor to it. Jamie Johnson as well. But there's also a character in there that I was trying to describe who is this guy. He's a little bit of a James Bondish character, which if you took Richard Branson of Virgin Atlantic and made him bad, and maybe tossed in George Soros when he hasn't had much fiber for a week, and you kind of have who. Who is who, and what is he doing in the background of the novel?
You know what? You know,
sorry
what
about that.
I just picked, you know, look, for a foreign name, whether they were Yemeni or Somali or Chinese, I found the easiest names I could pronounce, because when I write something, I want to read it out loud. And when I was reading these things aloud, I had to make sure that I could pronounce them. So one of the most common Chinese names is Hu, H-U. And I didn't realize it until somebody pointed it out to me very, very late in the process, where somebody's saying, you know, who is this guy? You know, it's kind of like who's on first. And
I love it.
He's a bit of a very shadowy character throughout the book. And, yes, we're going to see him again, who plays a larger and larger role in this series for a number of reasons. And he's the guy that I wanted to show the rise of China in both diplomacy and other things throughout the world. I was really struck when I was traveling throughout the Caribbean in 2006, I guess it was, hit six islands, and five of those islands had these Chinese arcs, Pafang, or, you know, they have the script on them, and they were building, they had Chinese construction folks on these islands, and, you know, it's like, why are they here? And then I was talking to some other friends of mine, and they, I was in Morocco, or I was in Mali, or wherever country they were in. Oh, yeah, there were Chinese construction folks everywhere. So who really represents the growing national interest of China? Who do you think he is?
Who? Actually, Claude, just before I hand it over to Eagle One, when I'm reading the book, I try to get visual pictures of it. One reason I kept grinning is he kept reminding me of the Chinese character from The Hangover. I just pictured him dressed like that, white shirt, dark pants, big sunglasses, but with gray hair. Don't know why, but that was it. Eagle One.
I got to see that movie.
So Boston Maggie claims that's her on page 14. The barkeep in Scotland. You're going to have to disabuse her, I think, of that opinion.
She's becoming insufferable.
Yes, she is. Oh,
yeah.
I'm supposed to ask a question.
No, it's okay. Now, Eagle One, I will say Boston Maggie can believe anything she wants, and I will support her 100%.
Uh-oh. That's just
you are a nerd.
Now you've done it.
No, the character of Maggie is at the beginning of the book, is she's a barkeep. She's a very tough barkeep, owns the bar in Ullapool, Scotland, and she is Stark's interest at the beginning of the book. And we'll leave it at that.
Well, now she's laughing at me. Okay, well, let's. You have, in addition to this book, you've written a number of nonfiction pieces, and I guess my question is kind of addressed at where are you going from here? What's coming up next in addition to sequels to this book? What have you got on the nonfiction side of the house?
Working on two articles right now on very, very different issues that I haven't dealt with before. That I'm going to submit hopefully to Foreign Policy or Foreign Affairs and a couple of others. But the big project I'm working on right now is my doctoral dissertation, and I'm really hoping I finish this puppy. I'm actually defending my first chapter and proposal next month through the University of Leeds, and if we can get by there, then the next year and a half is going to be trying to finish it. And my dissertation advisor wants me to turn this into a book because he thinks I should. And I don't know about it yet, but it's something a little different. It's on Andrew Jackson's Navy, and you know, he seems to think that I've uncovered a bunch of things that hadn't been considered before, and found some items in the National Archives that nobody's found before. So hopefully I can change some views on it and on the history of the Navy, and see where we go from there, rather than writing a dissertation that, you know, will have an audience of 3 or 4 people and will never see the light of day.
Yeah, I hope you can take that path, Claude. I remember a few years back when you told me the area of time that you were focusing on, and there just really hasn't been, at least from a maritime perspective, much time spent on that critical period. You know, you hear Jeff Boats, 3 sentences, and they go on to something else. So I hope it does go into a book, because I'll definitely be in line to grab it. Hey, I wanted, while we're talking about writing and kind of the second and third order effects of it, something we touched on earlier in the show is whether you're doing fiction or nonfiction. And as being somebody background of teaching, I'm sure you can appreciate this, but writing is also a chance to teach, to make points and observations subtly, so they can soak in with individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked a little bit about the anti-leader that is represented as CEO of the Bennington, who, by the way, I know people like that. They do actually exist, and yeah, you can read about them in Navy Times somewhere. I'll bring up, you know, a couple of your minor characters again. There also were some certain leadership archetypes in there. We saw a little bit in Ensign Fisk, and also Jamie Johnson representing mm-hmm. different types of leadership styles and ways of reacting to crisis and understanding mission and perhaps the morality of leadership. Was that also something you were trying to do, was to pull in and show different types of archetypes and how they react under stress?
Absolutely. In fact, I spoke to somebody who's she's a retired Navy commander, and she's on the leadership speaking circuit now. And I really wanted that you're right, because I had been in class with these future naval leaders, I did want a thread where I could, if I wanted to, not use the book in class. I don't teach leadership. Well, I mean, the formal leadership class, I should say. If people wanted to use this book and look at the various characters and how they exhibit leadership or don't, or their different leadership styles, yeah, absolutely, I did that, especially with Connor, with CJ, with who, with Elliot Green, the White House Chief of Staff, with, I'd probably say about 8 or 9 of the characters, where I could actually provide a list of questions if there was a leadership class, whether it's a university level or something more professional level in career-wise with civilians. Absolutely, that I wanted to do that. So I'm glad it came through. That's good to know.
Well, as you look forward, and I gather you have a sequel and a whatever the next thing, the second sequel in mind. You've already got this kind of, there's some kind of map you've got of where you're going with this stuff, and how far in advance? I mean, how many books do you foresee in this with these characters going forward?
The current story arc that I've outlined has 4 sequels to it, and you know, either one of 2 things will happen. Well, 1 of 3 things. The first thing is that I won't write the sequel because this book won't sell enough. If they do sell enough, then I'll complete the arc. And if they sell really well, then I think there's expansion opportunities beyond 5 total books. But there are really 4 storylines beyond the Aiden effect that I want to cover with these characters and really culminate with that 5th book. So I've already got those out, roughly outlined. And I'm starting to work on the second one, but I really have to hold off for another month or two while I deal with this PhD thing.
Well, let me interrupt here. When you do an outline, are you mapping these out? Do you have a storyboard that you foresee how these things are going exactly? How do you write your mm-hmm. What's your writing style for these things?
I just take a lot of notes and. You know, wherever I am in the day, if I start to think about it, like what would happen if I just ask myself, I try to ask myself more questions than I can answer, and I start from there. Then with the Aiden effect, I actually created an Excel spreadsheet. I said, okay, I'm going to have at least some sort of framework. Here are 42 cells in my Excel spreadsheet, and I want three parts. So each chapter, and including subchapters, is going to be 14. So there'll be three sections of the 42 chapters. So at least I had that framework, and I knew that I hate to make this sound really formulaic, but this is just how I treated the first draft. Then I took that Excel spreadsheet and I created two more columns so that I could have three concurrent storylines happening throughout each of the chapters. If you're following me, so that I could then see, all right, this happens to happen here. Oh, wait a minute, this was supposed to happen in chapter 13, not chapter 17, and that was one of the problems actually I had in editing. And you know, I just did an interview in Tucson right before I came on the show with you guys for an hour, and I noted one thing that this is not the fault of Naval Institute Press. This is totally my bad. There's just a minor thing where Damian Golzari has a 6 hour. He uses a 6 hour, which is what the State Department uses. And it's a 9mm. And at one point, I have him with the SIG 5.56, which is a rifle. And I was like, I just realized as I was going through the editing process, like, oh shoot, you know, it's. I meant to say, but that's what happens when you're doing the edits is. When you're going through 20 or 25 iterations of the book, you're like, shoot, you know, I totally forgot about that. Or, wait a minute, did Faisal, the character, say this to Abdi, or did he say it to who? And that's the problem I got. The big macro outline is not the problem. The smaller one is as you get into the dialogue and into the prose, how you make sure that it is all not only credible, but it is consistent. And I think that's the only thing that was inconsistent was at one point he picks up his pistol. It's another one, a rifle, which the State Department doesn't use. So I think that was the only thing that I glitched on. And again, totally my fault. Don't blame Naval Institute Press. They were. I can't begin to tell you how great they were throughout this whole process. So anyway, that's my NIP plug.
There you go. Hey, speaking of the Naval Institute Press, I prefer nonfiction, but obviously your book is fiction. I'm also reading another book of fiction right now, Stephen Phillips, The Recipient's Son, and we hope to have him here on Mid-Rat for probably a 30-minute slot sometime in the next couple of months. And I was reminded that one thing that we're just not seeing from those, both you and Stephen Phillips, obviously have a naval background, is whether it's naval background, Marine Corps background, anything. There really hasn't been much nonfiction writing about what's happened in the last decade and a half. Are there some nonfiction authors out there that you know of that are probably going to produce some quality books, nonfiction, to tell the story of the last 10 years? Because it seems like a lot of the issues that we should be addressing, his book obviously takes place in the 1990s, not really applicable. Mm-hmm. But how long are we going to have to wait till we start getting the types of books that we should have been having at least the last half decade and what we've seen in the last decade?
I think in the not-too-distant future, the story mostly has been told by junior Army and Marine personnel. But I do know of one Navy captain. I can't say his name right now because I don't want to put him on the spot. But I do know he's working on his book about Afghanistan. He's been there, and he's doing a historical thing about it. You know, there have been some other books that have given some broader perspectives and some not so broad perspectives. You know, I just got up on chat. I see BJ mentioned Shadow of Greatness. I don't see that as a 10-year study. I see that as snippets of individuals who have done some great things, clearly, but I don't see that as a macro perspective on what's gone on in the world or what's gone on in with regard to the Navy or anything else. I think those are shorter stories than they are of the broader story to be told.
Well, Claude, that kind of wraps up the show for the day. First of all, I know you've been a lot of busy work flogging the novel, so to speak, but I appreciate your quick turnaround and being able to join us here on Mid-Rats to actually talk about one of your novels.
Hey, thanks, guys. I really appreciate it.
Hey, so are you going to do an old-school book tour where we can throw eggs at you while you sign books at a table or what?
You know, I'm really trying to reach an audience wherever they are. I'll be doing a couple of book signings at bookstores, but I think really the big thing is to do as many interviews as I can to reach a broader audience. If you look at the cost-benefit analysis, I think you can just reach more people with a bunch of interviews, to be quite frank. It's not to say I won't do book signings. In fact, heck, last week I did one larger talk, and I did one that was just with about 30 folks at a book club. I'd like to do book clubs. I think it's kind of neat to talk to them about it. But just for signing a few books at the bookstore, I don't think you generally sell enough based on my experience, especially my first book. So there has to be a strategy in terms of this. You know, I know no writer likes to admit this, but every writer has to be a capitalist, and you have to understand marketing. So,
well, if you got a story to tell, if nobody reads it, then it's not told. Maybe we can pull somebody who knows C-SPAN and get you up on there. But I wish you luck with the rest of the tour of the book.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Claude, for being on. Good interview. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Real quick hour. And I want to thank everybody for joining us live today, or even for those getting us in the archive. Please join us again for another episode of MidRats.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go.
When you don't go to Geico.com, car insurance can be confusing. Like Swedish techno confusing.
Bark, bark, meow, meow. Dance with me, purple cow. Bark, bark, meow, meow. Ooh, you lovely cow.
Geico makes it easy. With 24/7 access, all you have to do is go to Geico.com and you could save money on car insurance. It just makes sense. Unlike, you know.
Dance with me, purple cow. I like your moves.
When you don't go to Geico.com, car insurance can be confusing. Like Swedish techno confusing.
Bark, bark, meow, meow. Dance with me, purple cow. Bark, bark, meow, meow. Ooh, you lovely cow.
Geico makes it easy. With 24/7 access, all you have to do is go to Geico.com and you could save money on car insurance. It just makes sense. Unlike, you know.
Dance with me, purple cow. I like your move.